It's Thursday, September 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, an independent report implicates Moscow in the shootdown of a Malaysian passenger jet.
He was never really popular in the sense that he was taken to be a charismatic leader, you know. He was more respected as a statesman.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres dies. Also ahead, oil lubricates financial markets. And we celebrate 40 years of a music masterpiece. It's all on today's International Edition. A two-year multinational investigation into what caused the crash of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur in July 2014 has concluded it was shot down by a missile brought in from Russia to rebel-held territory in Ukraine. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell in London tells International Edition host Sarah Williams that Moscow disputes the findings and denies involvement.
It's based on a whole range of forensic evidence that the investigators presented to reporters today in the Netherlands. First of all, this missile that they say shot down flight MH17, a Buk SA-11 missile, it's well known to many of the governments in the former Soviet states. It's still widely used in that part of the world. So there is credible military knowledge of this weapon, and using the remains, the fragments of the airliner, investigators were able to piece together where the missile hit the plane, to identify it by the shrapnel and the type of explosion that happened on the airliner, and then through that to trace the flight path of the missile and track that to the rough area in rebel-held Ukraine where it was fired from. Secondly, they were able to use satellite imagery, which showed the scorch marks in this field where they say that the missile was launched from. And that was backed up by several eyewitness accounts. They've managed to get anonymous and named eyewitness accounts from the scene. They've intercepted phone calls and social media accounts at the time, which many rebel commanders were boasting about shooting down another Ukrainian military plane, but then quickly turned to panic as they realized it was a civilian airliner. And lastly, they were able to use videos that were posted on YouTube and other video sources, geotagged videos, so they were able to identify exactly where they were taken, to trace the path of the missile launcher as it was taken from Russia to the launch site in Ukraine, and then back again to Russia after the missile had been launched, with the videos clearly showing two missiles missing from the launcher, one used to shoot down MH17, another used to shoot down, they think, a Ukrainian military transporter earlier that week in July 2014.
And what has been the Russian reaction to this investigation?
They have dismissed the findings. They say that the investigation is biased and politically motivated. They've long denied having any involvement in the downing of MH17, although they have changed their story several times. First of all, claiming that it was a Ukrainian jet fighter that shot down the airliner, then claiming to have evidence that it was a different type of missile that was fired from Ukrainian government territory that took down the plane. Then the maker of the SA-11 missile said it was their missile that shot down MH17, but they said it was an old version that the Russians didn't have. And the latest development from the Russian side is they presented their own satellite and radar imagery earlier this week, claiming to dispute the findings and saying that that a SA-11 was shot from Ukrainian territory. So the Kremlin really working overtime to try to dispute the findings of this investigation. But it should be stated, this isn't just a NATO or a Western investigation. This was a multinational team, including investigators from Malaysia, from Ukraine, Belgium, the Netherlands, and other countries looking into the accident.
Henry Ridgewell adds that with the finger of blame pointing squarely at Moscow, analysts say relations between the West and Russia are likely to deteriorate further. It's time now for us to check out what's buzzing online. Our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is here in Studio 22 with the trending stories. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. It looks like the U.S. government officials' grilling of Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf is working. I'm talking about the recent Senate Banking Committee's hearing about the bank's systematic cross-selling of as many as 2 million unauthorized accounts. Now, the problem there is that it forced the employees to pressure its customers to open up to 8 accounts per person when the average is just 2, a savings account and a checking account. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren played an integral role in the previous event, and on Wednesday, the bank announced it will claw back $41 million from Stumpf, which is kind of a penny compared to how much he actually has.
Well, I mean, the bank's going to be recovering some of the money that it has already dispersed to Stumpf as a penalty, I presume. So what does Warren have to say about this?
Well, she's still calling it for more accountability, and these are just a couple of tweets she sent out earlier today. She wrote, "This is a small step in the right direction, but nowhere near real accountability." She also wrote, "As I said last week, Mr. Stumpf should resign, return every nickel he made while the scam was ongoing, and face SEC and DOJ investigations." She's on Twitter at SenWarren. Wells Fargo is also on Twitter at Wells Fargo, but its latest tweet is from more than a week ago when it tweeted, "We are committed to rebuilding trust with our customers and the public." Lawmakers are expected to continue to grill Wells Fargo at Thursday's hearing in front of the House of Representatives Committee.
Okay, well, from big banks, what else are people talking about?
Well, yet another development from the mobile handset industry. As you know, it's a very fast-changing industry, and we talked about the new iPhone release, the battery issue with Galaxy Note 7, and the affordable Nokia phone. But this time, it's about BlackBerry. After posting $372 million quarterly loss, the Canadian tech firm said it will outsource all hardware development to focus on software. So no more BlackBerries.
Okay. Well, I had a sort of BlackBerry knockoff once.
Knockoff. Well, that's all for me today, Jim.
Thank you for that great wrap-up, G. You can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE on whatever device you might happen to have, or on our individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: Amnesty cancels Thailand torture report event after police warnings. THAAD opposition fades after fifth North Korean nuke test. U.S. probes more Chinese firms for breaching DPRK sanctions. Uber begins food delivery in Japan after rideshare stumbles. East Timor takes maritime dispute with Australia to the United Nations court. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more found on our voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Israel's foreign ministry on Wednesday said President Barack Obama and Pope Francis will be among the world dignitaries who plan to attend the funeral of the late Nobel laureate, President and Prime Minister of Israel Shimon Peres, who died Wednesday at age 93 after suffering a stroke. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a former political rival, issued a statement expressing his deep personal grief at Peres's passing. He lauded him as a visionary and a champion of Israel's defense. Peres was a co-recipient of the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize for seeking peace with the Palestinians. Joseph Olmert, a political science professor at the University of South Carolina, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, "It's hard to imagine life in Israel without Mr. Peres, who did not always advocate peace with Israel's Arab neighbors."
He started his political career, surprisingly enough, as hawkish. You know, he was very hawkish. He was a member of the group of youngsters around Ben-Gurion that were called Ben-Gurion children, you know, not his natural children, but his political children. He changed his politics sometime in the late 1970s onwards and became very much involved with what would then become, later on, 1993, the Oslo Accords.
Was there an event in his life that caused that change?
It's not clear to me exactly what was the trigger for this change, you know. I think that part of it may have had to do with the fact that In his lifetime, there was the big, political change in Israel, you know, the demographic change, which led the Israeli public opinion from left to right. And he was left on the left side of politics. The point is that he changed. He was never really popular in the sense that he was taken to be a charismatic leader, you know. He was more respected as a statesman.
He has been part of almost every major development from the country's founding in 1948. He served in a dozen cabinets, was twice Labor prime minister.
In a way, that really diminished his stature in his last years because he was taken to be the ultimate politician. He was around all over the place, you know. Even though his image changed in the last few years and he became finally accepted as a more nationally acclaimed and acceptable politician or public figure because he didn't have any more public positions after he retired, you know, from the presidency.
He was co-recipient in 1994, of course, of the Nobel Peace Prize along with Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat.
That was, by the way, controversial later on in Israel because the Oslo Accord seems to have collapsed more or less in the late 1990s and onwards. But you have to understand that he represented the type of Israeli politics which more or less became less relevant when Likud came to power in the 1970s and onwards because the demographic changes in Israel made it very clear that the left wing can hardly come back to power, and he therefore was somehow doomed, you know, to be the kind of leader that talks about the dangers of the facing the state, you know, the challenges for the future, but he was never again taken to be a real candidate for national leadership in the last, say, 20 years of his life.
Joseph Olmert said Peres's legacy as a revered statesman is assured, but it will also be controversial, with many younger Israelis having rejected his long struggle to forge peace with the Palestinians. Peres's body is to lie in state in the Israeli Knesset Thursday before burial in the country's National Cemetery in Jerusalem on Friday. Financial markets are moving on oil news again ahead of an OPEC meeting. We meet with VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino from New York with the latest.
Reuters just reported at about 2:30 on Wednesday, and this is according to sources, that OPEC reached a deal to limit oil production at the informal meeting that they've held over the past 3 days, although full details are unlikely to be firmed up before the formal meeting in November. But here's the thing. They're still producing at record levels around 33 million barrels per day. The sources say they cut it down about a million. Now, it's okay, so what are they going to do to draw down the supply glut is what the question is. You have to remember, too, that Russia is not an OPEC member. So if there is a supply cut, chances are they will come in to fill in the gap. So I don't think we're going to see any significant drawdowns based on these production cuts. You have to remember that OPEC, especially the members geographically in the Middle East, they're what's called swing producers. They can produce at much lower oil prices than anyone else can on the planet. The total cost per barrel in Saudi Arabia is just about $9. Therefore, they have the most leverage in the market.
We've seen U.S. markets spike on this news quite dramatically for some companies.
Yeah, of course, the energy-related sector, it certainly spiked on that. I think where oil is trading right now in that $40 to $50 range is the appropriate level that it should be at. You have to remember, anytime we see it get to the higher 40s, early 50s, you see producers turn the spigot back on, and that only adds to the supply glut. Based on fundamental supply and demand globally, this seems to be the appropriate level where oil should be trading right now.
Well, elsewhere in the markets, certainly one of the most recognizable brand logos is that Nike swoosh. What's happening with Nike?
Nike reported earnings after the close on Tuesday, and they beat analyst estimates, which is a good thing. The quality of the beat is why we saw some volatility in the stock price. The beat was supported by a lower effective tax rate and share buybacks. Anytime you see share buybacks in the engineering of the earnings, that doesn't really lend to bottom line growth, but more fancy accounting work. worldwide futures orders. Now, futures orders is an important component to look at when you have international retail companies like a Nike. Future orders are a measure of demand from retail stores and a forward-looking gauge of sales. It rose 7%. Analysts had expected 8%. Now, that's also excluding the impact of currency fluctuations. Futures orders in North America, they were also weaker than expected. They rose 1%. The estimated gain was 5%. Now, why do we think that futures orders are down? And the retail sector is one that I follow the most closely. Everything in retail is based on the have and the have-nots. And the biggest trend since the end of 2014 has been athleisure, basically wearing yoga wear around, tracksuits becoming more on mainstream. You're even starting to see it on the runways at the New York, Paris, and Milan fashion shows. The company has lost market share in clothing and footwear to rivals like Adidas that are also capturing this trend. Also, Under Armour is another one that took a lot of market share. They've done great with the deal with Steph Curry. And I also think part of the reason why Nike might be losing some share is that they've also launched cheaper models. So the key thing that you have to look at when you're focusing on the athleisure brands is who's endorsing them. Is it LeBron James? Is it Steph Curry? Who's capturing on this athleisure trend? Because I'll tell you anecdotally, that's all I wear outside of the office.
Paying attention to the futures while we live in the moment with Jill Malandrino from New York. Jill, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if you're interested in improving your personal market share, just go to voanews.com for more from Jill Malandrino and all of the other day's events. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and go to Facebook, VOA Now. You can like us while you're there. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Oh my goodness, it's been 40 years since Stevie Wonder's groundbreaking album Songs in the Key of Life was released. Let me tell you, if you're under 40 years of age and you haven't heard this, listen to it now. It's timeless. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the album and how it's still breaking ground 40 years after its release.
I mean, I think this is one of those albums where you start with the first track on the first album or first CD, and you go all the way through until the end. I don't think there's a miss there. Now, I think it's also important to remember that this album was released in 1976. And if you use that context and listen to it now, 40 years later, it'll be interesting to see and to hear that the more things change, the more they stay the same. But also musically, how this album influenced the sound of R&B and soul music and pop music and funk music and continues to do so to this day. We hear it sampled, cut sampled in hip hop songs that are popular today. And of course, I mean, ask any soul artist, any R&B artist, any country artist today. They'll probably tell you that Stevie Wonder was a huge influence on their work.
And some of the tunes that people might recognize off of this, I Wish, Sir Duke.
Isn't She Lovely? Which featured his daughter, who had just been born not too soon before.
Yeah, and all of these are, you know, when you say Stevie Wonder, like if you were to do a catalog, like
right.
Frank Sinatra had the Columbia years, or what? If you were to do a catalog, the tunes on this album would be the names that would come up first.
Right. Or Dave, if you were to do a playlist, because that's what we're doing now. If you're going to do your digital playlist.
Sorry.
I'm old.
These will be the songs on your Stevie Wonder playlist. Absolutely. But, I mean, one of my favorite songs on this project is Pastime Paradise. And I remember this album. I was very young when it was released. I was a baby. But the album was always in our home. We had the actual vinyl. We had the tape, the cassette tape.
The 8-track? No.
No, we didn't have an 8-track. But we had the cassette tape. And then I bought the CD when I was in college. And I still have both the vinyl and the CD. It was that important to me growing up in Detroit, me having parents who were really big into the sound of Motown, and then also what was going on in the world, social justice. And if you grew up in a time or around people who were concerned about what was going on in the world, it was Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, and it was Songs in the Key of Life. Like, those two albums you had to have. And so I remember Pastime Paradise, and then I remember many years later, Coolio sampled that song and it became a huge hit with his Gangster's Paradise. So again, as I say, this album has influenced urban music and even pop music for the last 40 years.
Well, how about you? Do you have a favorite Stevie Wonder tune from Songs in the Key of Life? Let us know. You can hit Shauna up. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA One The Hits. And you can always log on to our website and find the Soul Lounge there. That's at voanews.com.
In deference to my colleague David Byrd, I don't think I could pick just one from that album, or two, or three. It's the whole thing. Come on. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. We'd love to have you come back when you can. Have a super day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations estimates that there are currently more than 65 million people who have been forcibly displaced from their homes. Some 21 million of them have fled across international borders, while the rest are displaced within their own country but cannot return home. It is no exaggeration to say that this has become a global humanitarian crisis, in some places a catastrophe, as Secretary of State John Kerry said in a speech in New York on September 19th at the UN General Assembly high-level meeting on refugees and migrants.
It is in the world's singular interests, best interests, and it is right to ensure that people who desperately need a new home, whether in or beyond the boundaries of their own country, can actually find a place to live in safety with food, medicine, school, and a time to plan for what comes next. The task of providing such a refuge falls most heavily on those states that are directly embroiled in strife, their neighbors, and on the nations along nearby exit corridors. But the responsibility to assist is shared by all. So we have to do our part to try to end wars, to oppose violent extremism, to respect human rights, and to support policies that humanely and effectively manage the flow of people who are on the move.
The UN General Assembly approved the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants, a non-binding document meant to standardize the response to refugee situations, to provide better education prospects for children, and to improve working opportunities for refugees. The world knows what it must do to respond effectively to the massive challenge that we face, said Secretary of State Kerry, noting that the United States is proud to be the world's largest donor of humanitarian assistance and refugee relief. He said that the gap between the funds that we have and the funds that we need remains enormous. We are determined to work with all of you to create more opportunities for refugees, to provide more fully for the special needs of women, children, and people in danger of persecution, and to furnish additional help to countries that are on the front lines of humanitarian crises. To these ends and more, we ask your support, and we pledge our own continued best efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.